You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming online at kboo.fm.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Once a Braided River on Tuesday, May 16th from 7 p.m. to 9 p.m. at Cinema 21 in Portland. Once a Braided River is a documentary film by Barbara Bernstein. The film tells the story of the Willamette River before it was transformed into a Superfund site. The documentary features community groups and activists working to replace the zone and explores their vision to reclaim this stretch of river as a place where people and wildlife can thrive. Again, that's Once a Braided River on Tuesday, May 16th from 7 p.m. to 9 p.m. at Cinema 21, 616 Northwest 21st Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Did you know that KBOO is streaming live on the web? Well, you do now. Just type www.kboo.fm, click on Listen Live, and you've got us. Just another example of how KBOO 90.7 FM Portland works for you. It's your community radio.
This is Rising Up with Sonali, a weekly news and analysis program focused on economic, racial, gender justice, and more. I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar, and you can find us online at risingupwithsonali.com. This week, we'll examine remedies to Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas's corruption in light of two explosive stories by ProPublica revealing Thomas's financial ties to a billionaire. Ana Lilia Mejia of the Center for Popular Democracy will make the case for court expansion. Then we'll turn to Eric Lecomte of Jubilee USA Network for a report back on how recent high-level meetings of the World Bank, IMF, and G20 finance ministers, which flew under the news radar, had significant impacts on inequality, poverty, climate, the pandemic, and debt relief. Finally, Steve Phillips, best-selling author of Brown is the New White, will join me to discuss his latest book, How We Win the Civil War, Securing a Multiracial Democracy and Ending White Supremacy for Good. That's coming up in just a moment. This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on community and independent radio stations nationwide. A pair of new investigative reports from ProPublica about Clarence Thomas have fueled calls for the Supreme Court Justice's resignation. The first bombshell story, Clarence Thomas and the Billionaire, highlighted how a wealthy man named Harlan Crow befriended Thomas after he became a Supreme Court justice and treated him and his wife, Ginny Thomas, to luxurious vacations on a near annual basis. Thomas did not disclose the trips as he was required to. ProPublica followed that up just days later with another story whose title says it all. Billionaire Harlan Crow bought property from Clarence Thomas. The justice didn't disclose the deal. Now, groups like the Center for Popular Democracy are calling on Thomas to resign and for the court to be expanded. My guest is Ana Lilia Mejia, co-executive director of the Center for Popular Democracy. Welcome to the program, Ana Lilia. So let's start by first giving me a sense of why there are these growing forces for Clarence Thomas To resign. He is claiming that he just erroneously, or he's claiming that he was advised to not disclose these dealings with a billionaire. He's now amending. We're seeing on Tuesday that he's amending his disclosures to include his dealings with Harlan Crow. But legal experts are claiming that he clearly broke the law. Do you agree?
Yeah, I it sounds suspiciously like arguments that my 11-year-old son would make, that despite the fact that the rules have been clearly stated, that it is obviously a course of action that runs counter to what is acceptable in the position that he holds, that somehow he didn't know and is claiming just oops. And that's insufficient explanation or even excuse for someone that sits on one of the highest courts in our land, and that this, and someone that occupies such a critical and important position in American democracy. Our governance is predicated on a three-legged stool that works with transparency and in alignment for the people. And in having these undisclosed dealings that most certainly are coloring the way he's viewing both the world and potentially impacting his rulings, you know, having these undisclosed dealings is problematic for him if he sat in any court within our judiciary system, but most certainly in sitting in the highest court of the land.
I understand that it was regulations enacted after the Watergate scandal that required officials and Supreme Court justices like Clarence Thomas to reveal financial disclosures. They're supposed to talk about and let the public know any dealings they've had. And yet he went on these luxury vacations, as the ProPublica articles revealed. And then this billionaire basically bought a house for his mother and remodeled it. His mother, Clarence Thomas's mother, continues to live in a house that Harlan Crow, a billionaire, owns and has made expensive renovations to, and he didn't tell anybody that. We were supposed to have the issue of term of lifetime terms was supposed to protect Supreme Court justices from undue influence, but it seems as though it's just protecting them from accountability now.
Well, so there's many things at play here. I will share that as a former government official, I worked for the Biden administration. We had very clear rules, ethics rules, that required us to disclose financial gifts or any conflicts of interest. And I most certainly was not at the level of Justice Clarence Thomas, or had the level, the reach of impact on any singular decision that he currently holds. The examples you gave, there are many, there are too plentiful, but even one instance in which a monetary gift that could sway or influence was transferred over to Clarence Thomas or anyone in his immediate circle, it should have been reported. Period, end of story. Now, there has been many, many folks, including folks at my organization at CPD, who have sounded the alarm about the Supreme Court, because the reality is our Supreme Court has been taken over by radical extremists who have been using this excuse of originalism to strip Americans of their rights, right? The Dobbs decision is but one example in which this is actively happening in our Supreme Court. Many have opined on what can course correct here. As you have stated, one option on the table is to institute term limits. This may, perhaps it's helpful, perhaps it's not. I think it doesn't get to the core of the problem, which is, again, a court in which members do not have the ethics control and responsibility and transparency obligations that many other government officials in fact have. So there is, for example, the as you mentioned, term limits that are being proposed through the Term Act. There is a judicial ethics and anti-corruption proposal that has been put forward that will institute some of these ethics controls. But for us, we think, you know, the reality is that this court has been taken over by radicals. And so to us, the fix is we must expand the court. The bottom line is that we deserve a third leg in our American governance that is strong and steady and transparent and balanced. And right now we have none of that in our American judiciary system.
And just on the issue of the TERM Act, which is one of the proposed pieces of legislation, isn't it true that the United States is the only democracy in the world that has a Supreme Court with lifetime terms for their justices? Every other nation that's a democracy basically has limited terms. So Harlan Crow is, if you would, you know, can sort of think about his relationship with Clarence Thomas as an investment by a billionaire to ensure pro-billionaire policies. It's a lifetime subscription that's there. But term limits would certainly address that. But expanding the court would also, you know, we have only 9 justices, and it's a very, very large country. What is the appetite for expanding the court? The right wing likes to call it court packing, which has negative connotations.
Well, I mean, I think opponents of good ideas seek to deride them by you know, name calling. It's a tactic that children also use, by the way. I think the bottom line for American judiciary system is that we require additional transparency and ethics reforms. Without question, members of the highest court of the land should be bound by some of the same rules that some of the lowest level government employees are subject to. It is clear that this court has been taken over by, again, what I would call just radical justices who are using this concept of originalism, constitutional originalism, to strip anyone that in 1776 did not have rights. So that includes women, that includes people without property, that includes African Americans, people of color, like everyone except white land-owning men. So the bottom line for us is that there are several corrections that we must make. And you are right. We are out of step with many of our fellow brethren in other established and strong democracies in ensuring that this leg of government is strong and steady. I keep saying it to you, to your listeners, to your audience, and to folks who are members of CPD. If our government is a three-legged stool in which the executive, the legislative, and the judicial branch have to balance themselves, then that balance is predicated and supported by transparency, by accountability, by ethical behavior, and we must course correct when any of it is wrong. I mean, what will happen is that if that leg fails, the entire stool falls down. It is in all of our self-interest to pay close attention to what has happened with Justice Clarence Thomas. And by the way, he's not alone. Other justices had very similar issues, ethics and gift issues, and lack of reporting issues that have not been addressed. And we must. It's imperative that we do so.
The New York Times reported on the Supreme Court Historical Society, which is this charity that millionaires and others have access to. But finally, there's also calls for impeachment in the short term. Is that something that can happen? Only one other person on the court has ever been impeached, and then they were acquitted by the Senate. But there was one who resigned. It's highly unlikely, I think, that Clarence Thomas would resign. He seems to be sort of Trumpian in that way. And many Republicans tend to sort of dig their heels in when they face calls for resignation. So any short-term suggestions or hopes that you have for Clarence Thomas removing himself from the court?
I mean, I think, again, this is our government. This is our Supreme Court. This is our required accountability. We are the ones in the driving seat. We, the American people. And so, to be frank, it would be great if Clarence Thomas, if Justice Thomas did the right thing and not only fully disclosed his dealings, but stepped aside, because we do have a crisis of trust and confidence in our highest court. But I'm looking at the American people. I'm looking at us to hold our representatives accountable and to demand the kind of transparency and accountability that we demand of pretty much every other member of government. We are calling on our elected officials to fix the broken trust that currently exists in the highest court of the land. Our entire democracy is dependent on all of them doing the right thing. And if they do not, what we are prepared to do is to continue to lobby for the measures that can course correct. So we are hosting lobby days and educating elected officials and members of the community about the Judiciary Act and how we could expand the court in a way that's smart and responsible. We're going to continue to support measures that are making demands and instituting greater ethics to the highest court of the land. And we are going to continue to sound the alarm, because this is a problem that will impact every facet of American democracy right now, in the past, and in future.
Ana Lilia, thank you so much for joining us today. Good luck to you.
Thank you so much.
My guest has been Ana Lilia Mejia, who is the co-executive director of the Center for Popular Democracy. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. You can listen to this and other interviews on our website, risingupwithsonali.com, by becoming a subscriber. Find our audio podcast on iTunes and Spotify, and follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at RUWithSonali. This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on community and independent radio stations nationwide. A month after the Silicon Valley Bank collapsed, the World Bank and International Monetary Fund met in Washington, D.C. The meetings, which just wrapped up, were expected to focus on global economic stability within the context of rising inflation, central bank interest rate hikes, and the war in Ukraine. But most discussions appear to have taken place behind closed doors. Meanwhile, the G20 finance ministers meeting also took place in Washington, D.C., wrapping up last week. In all of these high-level international meetings, how did issues of debt, poverty, inequality, and the climate crisis play out? To help answer that question is Eric Lecomte, executive director of the Jubilee USA Network. Welcome to the program, Eric.
It's great to be with you, Sonali.
So first, these meetings used to take on significance in the United States 10, 20 years ago. It seems as though now very few people even realize that the World Bank is meeting or the IMF is meeting, but organizations like yours are still on top of it. How relevant, first of all, are these meetings and the decisions that they take? It seems as though, you know, even if we aren't paying attention to them, there's still a lot of decision-making happening.
That's right, Sonali. As the International Monetary Fund and World Bank and G20 meetings finished last week, we're realizing really how important these meetings were. Right now, the International Monetary Fund, the World Bank, and the G20 are the primary institutions that are working on global pandemic response, debt, tax, and trade policies. And also, these institutions will be making the most important and consequential decisions on climate change in our lifetime. It will not be the United Nations. And yet, the International Monetary Fund, the World Bank, and the G20 are institutions that many of us don't know what they are or don't realize the significance. In terms of our power analysis at Jubilee USA, we understand the International Monetary Fund to be the second most powerful institution on planet Earth, right after the White House. This particular institution not only is working on global structural pandemic response, but really is absolutely critical for our global economy, our U.S. economy, as well as our jobs. A lot of us who've never heard of the International Monetary Fund need to know that its policies on the global economy, its policies on our jobs and our livelihoods are incredibly significant, almost as significant as the oxygen we breathe. And yet many people don't know about these institutions. They had their spring meetings over the past week, and unfortunately, the economic reports that came out from the meetings are the most concerning economic reports the International Monetary Fund has ever released. They are continuing to talk about a global economy in crisis, and now are forecasting an even worse economy than they did a year ago. So these institutions and the decisions that they make, the International Monetary Fund, the World Bank, and the G20, are the primary institutions that are making decisions on global poverty, inequality, as well as climate change.
Now, the issue in particular of global financial stability, given the collapse of Silicon Valley Bank, is critical. The U.S. has been raising interest rates to curb inflation instead of regulating corporate profits, which is arguably the reason why we're seeing inflation. Corporations are raising prices because they can. But instead of trying to bring that under control, the Federal Reserve has been making it more expensive to borrow money, which of course impacts ordinary people. But it also, some have argued, was the reason why there was a run on money in the Silicon Valley Bank, resulting in the bank's collapse. How are other governments taking on the issue of inflation? Are they following the US's lead? And was that a topic of discussion at these recent meetings?
Yes, all these issues are intertwined and interconnected. The reality with the SVB banking crisis and the challenges we've had recently illustrate that we have a lot of risk in the global economy, the global financial system, as well as among corporations and businesses. We've seen that risk heightened because of the pandemic. Right now, what we're dealing with is a crisis unlike any crisis we've dealt with before, the most significant crisis since the Great Depression. And only two countries around the world, out of all countries, have experienced some modest recovery: United States and China. Most countries are still experiencing crisis. So the global financial stability analysis from the IMF and the G20 are incredibly troubling. Over the last week, as they've looked at the particular issues facing the global economy, they've sent out new warnings about global debt, as well as global challenges to the financial system. These particular challenges will need to be corrected and fixed very quickly. Since the dawn of the pandemic, we now are dealing with the highest level of countries ever facing crisis. 60% of all low-income and poor countries are in debt or financial crisis. So on the one hand, while the banking crisis of SVB illustrates challenges that need to be corrected within the system, now 3 years into the pandemic, we saw how the Federal Reserve and the U.S. Central Bank could deal with a $300 billion banking crisis overnight and restore confidence in the system. But now we're dealing 3 years with the greatest debt crisis the world has ever seen. We've seen poverty increase, inequality increase, as well as protections for the environment start to be lessened and lost. And as all of these things are happening, we realize that world leaders have not been quick enough to take action. At the International Monetary Fund, the G20, and World Bank meetings, while there was some progress, we're still moving very slowly on solving the debt crisis. And what the banking crisis showed is that when there is political will and ambition, we can solve these crises very quickly. But right now, even though world leaders are paying attention to the growing debt crisis, we're not moving quickly enough to solve the global economic crisis.
Let's talk about the issue of climate change. It continues to be an urgent issue. Financing and our financial systems are intimately involved with the climate crisis and fueling climate change, although you wouldn't get often that admission from world leaders and certainly not corporate executives. Was the climate an issue at these meetings? And if so, was there any declaration of support for climate justice policies from these governments?
Well, the International Monetary Fund and the G20 are taking climate change quite seriously. And at the direction of the U.S. Treasury, they're integrating climate change policies into every single area of IMF decisions. The World Bank is moving more slowly, but they are looking at the issue. The reality around climate change and the global climate crisis is why a lot of us pay attention to the United Nations and the Paris Accords. But the reality is the major decisions on climate change, as well as the financing and aid to deal with global climate mitigation and adaptation, to be able to deal with future disasters that are becoming more and more worse because of climate change, the reality is these decisions are going to be made by the IMF and G20, not by the United Nations. So over the next 5 years, all the major financing decisions for climate change will be made by the International Monetary Fund, by the G20. Whether or not countries around the world have the ability to adapt to climate change, to have mitigation efforts, is going to be largely because of the financing and aid that come from the IMF, the G20, and the World Bank. Since the dawn of the pandemic, these institutions in dealing with climate change have become more significant than the United Nations. And part of the reason for that is many of these critical decisions on climate change are going to be made as a part of pandemic response. Whether or not the aid and grants and loans and financing comes for countries to deal with climate change, it's going to come from the IMF and G20. One of the constructive things that have moved forward at the International Monetary Fund and the G20 is a new trust for developing middle-income and low-income countries to deal with climate change, to deal with mitigation and adaptation. The Resilience and Sustainability Trust is getting donations from wealthy countries so that developing countries can have the resources they need to deal with climate change. While this is progress, it's certainly not enough. And over the next year to 5 years, continuing significant decisions on climate change and solutions for the global climate crisis will be made by the IMF, the World Bank, and the G20.
What sort of pressure did these institutions face from the outside as they were meeting? All the meetings took place in Washington, D.C., and your organization and you were there. Were you joined by others who were there to pressure these, these high-level attendees that they need to continue to prioritize the poor, prioritize the climate, et cetera?
Hundreds of organizations attended the meetings in order to meet with world leaders and put pressure on them to deal with the global debt crisis, to deal with global corruption issues, to be able to solve the global climate crisis. So groups that range from unions to religious groups to development and aid groups like Oxfam and others came and attended the meetings in order to put pressure on world leaders to start to move forward with debt cancellation, to get a process that's already been approved moving forward quickly for debt relief. These organizations came together to put pressure on decisions to stop corruption and increase transparency, as well as for the IMF, G20, and World Bank to take the climate crisis and climate changes more seriously. So these particular organizations and groups came to the meeting this year. And since before the pandemic, we probably haven't seen as many groups and organizations come as they came during this meeting. Most of the meetings for the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank take place at the International Monetary Fund and World Bank headquarters that are located in Washington, D.C. And that's where these meetings took place this past week, and it's where generally most meetings for these institutions take place. So it was incredibly promising that so many advocates from around the world came to put pressure on the International Monetary Fund, the G20, and the World Bank on debt relief, on transparency, on dealing with climate change. While we heard a lot of strong voices and we got some movement on some of these issues, it's clear that the IMF and the G20 need to do more and need to do more quickly.
Was the United States and the Biden administration playing a constructive role in these meetings? I mean, unfortunately, traditionally, the United States hasn't always been a leader on issues of inequality or climate, et cetera.
Yeah, at this point, the United States government, with its leadership role in the G20 and the G7, is probably the strongest government in the entire world on these issues. I'm looking on debt, corruption, climate change. How do we get enough aid to deal with poverty and inequality? How do we get enough financing and aid to make sure that all countries have enough to deal with climate adaptation and climate mitigation, to prepare for future greater disasters because of climate change? Out of the entire G20, the United States is the most outspoken on debt relief and the most outspoken on climate change. Our team and our religious coalition and union and business and labor coalition at Jubilee USA has been meeting with the administration, has met with Secretary of Treasury Janet Yellen to go over the policies that they're focusing on. And right now, while we'd like the U.S. government to even play a greater champion role, it should be clear that the Biden administration is the strongest G7 and G20 government on these development, climate, and global economic issues.
Where's a good website that people can find out about the work that Jubilee USA Network does?
Well, thanks, Sonali. It's always good to join you. And if you go to www.jubileeusa.org, jubileeusa.org, you could find more about our campaigns with the IMF and G20.
Thank you again so much, Eric. Good luck to you.
Thank you, Sonali. Be well.
My guest has been Eric Lecompte, Executive Director of Jubilee USA Network. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. You can access this and other interviews on our website, risingupwithsonali.com, by becoming a subscriber. Find our audio podcast on iTunes and Spotify, and follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at RU with Sonali. This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on community and independent radio stations nationwide. The shooting of a 16-year-old black child named Ralph Yarl by an 84-year-old white man named Andrew Lester in Kansas City, Missouri, has renewed calls for gun control and so-called stand your ground laws to be revoked. But it has also brought up the question of violent white supremacist backlash to an increasingly diverse nation. More than 7 years ago, writer and thinker Steve Phillips was among the first to tackle this issue in his book, Brown is the New White: How the Demographic Revolution Has Created a New American Majority, which went on to become a New York Times bestseller. Phillips's new book is called How We Win the Civil War: Securing a Multiracial Democracy and Ending White Supremacy for Good. He's the founder of Democracy in Color and hosts the podcast Democracy in Color with Steve Phillips. He's also a columnist for The Guardian and The Nation and an opinion contributor to The New York Times. Welcome to the program, Steve.
Thanks for having me. Glad to be here.
So I had spoken to you in 2016 when Brown is the New White had, or maybe it was 2015 when it first came out. It was a long time ago. And I remember every time I have thought about the ways in which brown and black folks are entering office and winning victories and going on to strengthen our democracy, I've thought of you and the work that you've done. You have a new book out, and I'm wondering, when you wrote Brown is the New White, could you have ever predicted that something like the January 6th riot, which you open your book with, would have happened, this violent insurrection, a violent threat to our democracy?
Well, on the one hand, no, I don't think anybody would have predicted that, because it was in some levels unprecedented in terms of that particular type of manifestation. But if you really look at the history of the country, then actually it's not so surprising. And that was what was illuminating for me in doing the research and the history and then trying to tell the story of this country and how the Confederates have never stopped fighting the Civil War. The Civil War itself began when the candidate who was backed by black people won the election in 1860, and the losing side refused to accept the election results. And rather than accept those results, they seceded from the Union. And that is what laid the seeds for ultimately the beginning of the Civil War in 1861. So in many ways, it's actually not unprecedented, and it was not coincidental that the January 6th insurrection had people carrying the Confederate flag into the Capitol and wearing sweatshirts saying MAGA Civil War, January 6th, 2021.
And we've had in recent years, even leading up to January 6th, this struggle over history, right? The tearing down of, or the criticism over Confederate-era statues that remain in the United States, then the right-wing attacks on so-called critical race theory, all of which seem to suggest that this narrative around white supremacy has never truly been overturned and challenged, and has made the case, as you make in your book, that the Civil War never really ended. America never truly acknowledged the sin of slavery, never truly acknowledged and reconciled with the white supremacist origins of this nation, right?
Exactly. And so the resistance to the Civil War ending began immediately. And so April 9th, 1865 was the date that Robert E. Lee surrendered, ostensibly. A couple days later, Lincoln gives a speech from the White House where he mentions limited voting rights for African Americans, and John Wilkes Booth is at that speech. The speech was given, you know, outside at the White House. And he turns to a friend and says, "That means N-word citizenship." Mm-hmm. That's the last speech he'll ever give. And then 5 days after the supposed surrender at Appomattox, Wilkes Booth goes into the Ford Theater and shoots Lincoln in the back of the head. That's not surrendering at all. And so you need to go from that, as you're mentioning, all of the statues that were erected. There was a three-story high statue of Robert E. Lee erected in Richmond decades before we were able to actually get the Lincoln Memorial itself created.
And these statues came after the Civil War, which is an indication that they were actually a reaction to try to insist that the war is not over.
Exactly. This whole, we talk now about the big lie and what Trump has been trying to perpetuate, that is precedent in the lost cause mythology, where they tried to, in many ways successfully, recast the Civil War from a rebellion of white supremacist mass murderers to some kind of glorified noble cause defending their heritage. So these things have been going on unrelentingly, frankly, since the time of the Civil War and honestly, even before that.
Now, many commentators who are trying to understand the situation that we're in today trace the beginning of the white backlash to Obama's presidency and might argue, well, if the Civil War was never truly won, Obama would never have been able to be elected, and it's, you know, a constant struggle. How do you respond to that?
So that is what we tried to illustrate and outline in the first book, Brown is the New White. And that's frankly why I wrote Brown is the New White, is that, because it was clear to me, I mean, I came of age and Jesse Jackson's presidential campaigns was very explicitly connected to Martin Luther King and the Civil Rights Movement and an extension of that movement and that effort, that Obama would not have won election in 1980. He would not have beaten Reagan. Obama could only win in 2008 because the country was more racially diverse.
Uh-huh.
And if you took his formula, his percentages, 40% of white people, 80% of people of color, that was not a majority in 1980 and 1984. It's only as the country has gotten more diverse that it has become a majority of the population. And so that's what people don't understand. And that's when they try to point to make the wrong conclusions about Obama's election. Politics in this country has historically been a battle between white people. And it was conservative whites battling with progressive whites over the whites in the middle. And there were not enough people of color in the country who certainly were able to vote, but really, frankly, even in the country overall, to be able to flip the balance of elections. But that has changed. So people of color were 12% of the population in the 1960s, 40% today. So now people of color and progressive whites alone are the majority of people within the country. That's what propelled Obama to victory. It wasn't that there was some magical realization or awakening about how racism is no longer a factor in the country. It's that the pro-multiracial segment of whites could ally with people of color and elect a black man president.
So let's tease apart this idea that there is basically a battle between democracy and whiteness, and the sort of pro-Trump MAGA conservatives in the United States are choosing whiteness over democracy. That is a stark dichotomy to face. And how do you tease that apart? Because the idea of democracy is rule by people. But if the people themselves are increasingly not white, then we have this crisis of white folks who are very fearful, it seems, of democracy because they're fearful of people of color.
Correct. And so this has been an ongoing thread throughout the history of this country. And it's why one of the staples of the efforts of the original and modern day Confederates has been to suppress democracy. Is that you? And it began right after the Civil War and in the Reconstruction era, because in places like South Carolina and Mississippi, black people were the majority of people in those states. So they had to suppress democracy, mm-hmm. and if they really wanted to preserve white power in those areas. And so that is the title of the introduction, the choice between democracy and whiteness. And it's from a phrase that Taylor Branch uttered, who was the author of the Parting the Waters civil rights books. And he was talking with Isabel Wilkerson of CAST about the rise in white domestic terrorism under Trump, where you had people who were incited and inflamed, at least, by Trump's rhetoric to carry out white domestic terrorist mass murders, such as at the Tree of Life Synagogue in Pittsburgh, in response to all the demonizing of Central American immigrants. They're talking about caravans, et cetera. And White said, Taylor Branch said, I guess the question is, if people had a choice between democracy and whiteness, how many would choose whiteness? And Wilkerson says, we let that one hang in the air, neither of us willing to hazard a guess. But then we had it directly before us on January 6th. Where you had 50 states, 50 governors, Republicans and Democrats alike, certify the election results. That's the essence of a democracy. And rather than accept that democratic process and finalize that process to install Joe Biden as president, they stormed the United States Capitol with the Confederate flag to try to stop democracy in its tracks. And so that is not a hyperbolic or theoretical construct. We had an actual situation, and we had many people, including the former president of the United States, directly trying to destroy our democracy.
Now, I'm sure the situation that played out recently in Tennessee is something that you've thought quite a bit about. We had these two young Black lawmakers who were really a testament to the ways in which progressive people of color in general, are entering the political system. And then the clash that we saw when they were ousted unceremoniously by the largely white Republican majority in the Tennessee House of Representatives. Is that clash a playing out of the civil war that you write about?
Absolutely. And it's, again, another attack on democracy. And in democracy, particularly in terms of state legislatures, representatives choose their leaders, send their leaders to the seat of government, and then those leaders are all together, debate the policies and priorities for the society. And so what you had was the white-led leadership of the Tennessee state legislature removing the chosen leaders of Nashville and of Memphis without any kind of process at all. So then the people had chosen, we want these people to represent us, and they said, no, we're not going to allow you to be the chosen representative. That's just, again, another outright assault on democracy. But it's not surprising that it took place in a place like Tennessee and in the Tennessee state legislature. So the Tennessee state legislature in the 1970s voted to put in place a bust, a 3,000-pound bronze bust of Nathan Bedford Forrest, who was a slave dealer, a Confederate general, and the first Grand Wizard of the Ku Klux Klan. And the Tennessee state legislature says, we want to honor that man, and we're going to put a bust in the state capitol, the same state capitol for which they expelled the Justins. And they fought for it and defended it for more than 40 years, only removed over great protest after the murder of George Floyd. So Tennessee has a long and ignoble history of officially siding with the causes of white supremacy over multiracial democracy.
So let's talk about the very important part of your book, which is how we build a multiracial democracy. This is something that's already happening. It's in place on the federal level. It's happening on the state level, on the local level, that people of color are increasingly running for office and winning. They have the numbers to support them now, in large part because of the demographic changes that you're talking about. So tell me about this, the action plan, if you will, that you envision for ending white supremacy for good.
And so, yes, the whole second half of my book are case studies of places that have actually advanced white supremacy, advanced multiracial democracy over the forces of white supremacy. And I have five different case studies of states and regions that have had significant progress over the past decade. So one of them being Arizona, right, where the very first governor of Arizona had been the editor of a newspaper called The White Man. And it presided over what they called scalp dances, where the people would gather to dance under the scalps of Native Americans who had been killed by the whites trying to colonize that area. And then most significantly, so in Arizona also, they tried to block Martin Luther King's birthday being a holiday. And the most pertinent to the current moment is they passed this anti-immigrant bill, the Show Me Your Papers bill, in 2010. That really empowered local police to serve as, frankly, modern day slave catchers and round people up and ship them out of the country just based upon the suspicion, and it was largely people of color. But that process radicalized and politicized a whole generation of young people, people like Alex Gomez and Montserrat Redondo, who went on to create civic engagement organizations in Arizona. Lucha, One Arizona, Arizona Wins. And those organizations over the course of a decade have registered and mobilized hundreds of thousands of people of color, and Latinos of, in particular, to come into the electorate and change the composition of the electorate. And through that is how you had Biden defeat Trump in Arizona in 2020. You helped to flip the whole U.S. Senate by electing Mark Kelly to the Senate in 2020 and elected a Democrat as the governor, Katie Hobbs, in 2022. So that process of people of color building civic engagement organizations, increasing turnout of people of color, and then transforming the politics of that state and even the whole country is the formula. And it's a formula that has been proven and it is working across the country.
I'm wondering how the issue of the Second Amendment figures into this whole thing, because we have a country where conservative minority is increasingly armed, and, you know, an armed militia was what you might argue stormed to the Capitol on January 6th. Weapons are unfortunately a powerful antidote against democracy. And every other day, it seems, we see mass shootings. Some of them are racially motivated. Some are just random violence. And it figures into it, right? It's hard to have a democracy, in particular multiracial democracy, when a significant percentage of the population is very well armed. It's a frightening proposition.
It's true. It's interesting. The issue of gun control was the issue that led to the ouster of the justice in the Tennessee state legislature after a shooting at a school in Nashville. And so it was the protest in support of those community members who wanted some action to be taken was what led them to be ousted. But I do think it shows that there is, in fact, a multiracial majority of people who, when properly organized and invested in and inspired, can take control of the governing apparatus of the region and state and country, and by extension then take control of the police and law enforcement apparatus and operation. So that, and ultimately, although it was, you know, far later than it should have been in terms of even the January 6th insurrection, it was the government law enforcement forces which did ultimately repel the attack and secure the Capitol. So that's the reality that we face. And so we have to be clear-eyed about the intensity of people who are going to resist democracy, but also be clear that there has to be consequences in utilizing the full power of the state to protect the democracy. And so that really is the battle and the struggle that we're engaged in right now in the country.
Do we need to, alongside building the multiracial democracy, you know, with the model that you've suggested, do we need to find ways also to shift our culture? Because we can't very well write off such a significant portion of conservative whites who are choosing whiteness over democracy. Is part of the plan also to convince people that choosing democracy over white supremacy is in their best interest in the long term too?
Yes, and I think that there's two aspects to that. Part of it is culture. And I think that I'm hopeful in terms of particularly impacting young people, right? So many young people now have had a significant portion of their young lives having a Black man as president. And so that what that does in terms of what's, you know, your sense of possibility and who plays what roles, et cetera, is part of it. I think the other part is that we ultimately need to govern and deliver and change public policies that benefit everybody. And then that, and so healthcare is the perfect example of that. There's all this resistance to Obamacare on the theory that this was like a giveaway to Black people. But in point of fact, it made healthcare available to everybody. And there are, in fact, even people who not want to fully acknowledge it, many white people, many white conservatives, many white neo-Confederates who have better health care in this country because a black man pushed through health care reform in the federal government. So ultimately, I think that that's the way to maximize the support and reduce some of the opposition is by showing that. And even if you look historically, right, it wasn't that Rosa Parks wanted to desegregate the buses just so black people could ride. She wanted to desegregate the buses so public transportation would be accessible to everybody. And that is the ultimate goal and objective. And as we advance that mission, there really is really little basis for opposition to it, which is partly why they do so much distorting around what the actual agenda is.
And we've seen life expectancy rates in this country falling. There's been some analysis showing that the places where they're falling, because it's not geographically even, the places where they're falling are the places where Republican-led state-level policies have curtailed access to healthcare, have
You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282. BH Philomath on 104.3 FM and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM.
Calling all denizens of Earth. Tune in to KBOO on Saturday, April 22nd from 6 a.m. to 7 p.m. for KBOO's Earth Day Takeover. It's a whole day of radio programming devoted to climate action and environmental justice. Join us and prepare for nature sounds, music, and activist interviews focused on our shared climate future. That's KBOO's Earth Day Takeover on Saturday, April 22nd from 6 a.m. to 7 p.m. and online at kboo.fm/earthday.
Welcome to another episode of Civic Cypher. I am your host, Ramses Ja.
He is Ramses Ja. I am Q Ward. I see I got my voice back. I was starting to like the quiet.